Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
Hello everyone.
It is episode 63 and it is the 8th of June. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to one of our favourites, Dr. Bella DeBrera. She's back in the studio. We're going to be talking about her article in The Spectator Australia. Also about the Ramsay Foundation thing that you guys might have been reading about. And she's going to pitch us her new favourite TV show.
Yep.
We are also going to be playing the last of our interviews. Our interviews is in the IPA's interviews from the Friedman Conference. We are going to be talking to Jonathan Blanks from the Cato Institute about criminal justice things. So that interview was done by Chris Berg. Really cool chat about some of the more interesting sort of divisive criminal justice issues in the US, including what he made of the gay wedding cake decision, which came down since that interview's aired. But you can sort of hear what he sort of thinks about that and the sort of areas of law that it sort of comes up around.
Interesting piece about that in Hey What Did I Miss Yesterday, written by me.
Written by Peter. No, the Hay was written by Peter. Peter has never written an interesting piece in his life.
I included the link to a piece.
Yeah. So who is the real hero?
Yeah,
absolutely. So let's get into some stories around the world this week. So Pete, let's start off with the job report out of the US that caught your eye.
We always say, you know, the world's going badly. Everything's going poorly. This has been a little bit of news about this, but not that much news. In America, African-American unemployment hit its lowest rate ever in May. So they had their jobs report, came out last Friday, had all those statistics about unemployment. African-American unemployment reached its lowest point ever, which I think is awesome. And I think that's a real tribute to job creators in the United States and workers in the United States. And isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, it's interesting what would have happened if the president wasn't racist. Like how much it would have fallen if it wasn't racist.
I wanted to play this like straight and not do gags, but yes.
But like that's the point for me. Everyone's like up in arms saying Trump's racist, Trump's racist. Meanwhile, there's all these awesome things that are happening right now.
Yeah.
And exactly, like it's the blinkers that people have on of just they'll find the thing to hate Trump about. Like they'll spend all week talking about where the hell's Melania Trump after a kidney surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, there's all this good news that they're just not even going with.
Yeah, exactly right. So let me read you through some figures, James. The US economy added 223,000 jobs in May. Unemployment rate reached its lowest point since 2000, dipping to 3.8%. So unemployment dropped 0.5% in the last year. In addition to the African-American unemployment rate, which I just spoke about, Hispanics continue to experience near historic lows in unemployment, and the unemployment rate for women, which is 3.6%, is at its lowest point in decades. Now, obviously, that's not all to do with government policy. A lot of that's to do with just the economy. But clearly, cutting taxes and clearly reducing regulation has a huge impact on that.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
And I just think, as I said before, my takeout is, what a great thing for the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad that we also have a government that's so invested in cutting regulations, cutting red tape and lowering taxes to bring the same sort of effect into Australia. Oh, wait. Hang on.
I didn't realise that was a joke till the very end. And I was like, what?
Cool. So another story, unless you've got anything more on that one, Pete.
No, that's it.
So another story that's sort of been going around Australia, has been dominating the Australian and a few other papers this week has been the scandal happening with the Ramsay Centre for Western Civilization at Australian National University. So basically, the Ramsay Foundation were hoping to give some money to ANU to say you should have a bachelor for Western civilization, the same way there's like Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Science. It sounded like it was all going well. Pardon me. It sounded like it was all going well until right at the very end when ANU pulled out, saying that they didn't want this to go ahead. So that's a pretty big scandal because the a university that should be teaching people is turning its back on Western civilization, which is something that has talked about rationalism and talked about, you know, through science and the Enlightenment. That's how we get a lot of the things we know today, and now we're no longer studying where we've come from.
That's right, and of course the university is an institution of Western civilization, but it's also, apart from Western civilization, it's another blow to academic freedom in Australia. We had the Peter Ridd case, of course, which is still ongoing, and obviously Bjorn Lomborg a couple of years back. The thing that I found interesting, and I'm pretty confident I'll talk about this later with our interview with Bella, is that it's funny how the admin of universities, like for you to accept this centre into your university, you obviously have no idea that there's going to be this massive backlash against it from your Marxist staff, but it means you don't know what's going on in your university, really. Mm. So, I mean, it's not a surprise to me that university administrations are cowardly. It is a surprise to me that they seem to have so little knowledge of what's happening in their universities.
Yeah, yeah. Or just like, well, maybe if it's, you know, Bachelor of Residency and it's far away from the arts department, we'll get away with it. And no.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you guys want to know more about that, stick around for the interview with Dr. Bella DeBrera, because we're going to be talking about that a whole lot more. And there's also... What on earth was that?
the chair.
Oh, that was a chair?
Yeah.
I thought like a live bat had got into the office. Lost my train of thought. Bell also had an article in the Australian Financial Review, I want to say.
This morning, yeah.
Yep, this morning. That's also on our website now, so you can read that as well.
Can I make a point about that? Bella DeBrera, in case this emerges as a news story, Bella DeBrera saw her photo in the Australian Financial Review this morning and drew horns on her own photo.
Oh, okay.
So that's
getting ahead of the story. Is that the idea?
The last bastion of Western civilization in this country is drawing horns on her own picture.
Well, okay. What does that say?
I think we're in trouble.
Okay, cool. Let's talk CFMEU.
Yeah. Okay, good one. Good segue, James.
Good padding, Pete.
The CFMEU is a union, and the unions are very good at projecting this image that they are, you know, fuzzy-wuzzy organisations that care about their workers, and they just care about working people and creating a better world for those people.
Mm-hmm. Away
from those rich capitalists. But they keep doing stuff like this. So it emerged during the week that Vinnie Molina, WA president of the CFMEU, wrote to Julie Bishop, Australia's foreign minister, that she should recognise that the elections held in Venezuela in May, which are obviously sham elections. This guy was actually one of Maduro's, election observers. So, you know, we have election observers.
So Vinnie Molina, the CFMEU WA president, was an observer of the election.
For the Venezuelan government, right?
Okay,
so the Venezuelan government gets these observers to say, oh, look, here's our awesome...
Look at this democracy.
He's our awesome... Yeah, exactly.
Don't go behind that building, but look at this democracy.
Right, and he wrote, what I saw was an electorate with the freedom to cast their vote in an environment free of harassment and or violence. Now, the UN had a slightly different view of the elections, and their statement said the elections does not in any way fulfil minimal conditions of free and credible elections. And the UN received credible reports of hundreds of extrajudicial killings in recent years, both during protests and security operations. So, you know, and Vinnie Molina is also the president of the Australian Communist Party Central Committee. So we can laugh at these people and say, you know, that's quite funny that someone would still have the view that Venezuela is a good government. But, of course, we must remember that the unions control the government for 30 to 40% of the time.
Yes. Well, I was also going to say, like, of course, Molina liked the elections because, as you say, he's a president of the Communist Party of Australia. And nothing... Mm-hmm. What says more about the triumph of communism than extrajudicial killings in the lead up to an election?
That's
right. That's just communism. He would have just gone, yeah, this is how it's supposed to be, isn't it?
Yep. Everything's operating... As it should.
Yeah, exactly. This is what history has taught us is how we do things now.
And this is not the first time this has happened to CFMEU. And I think the MUA last year sent a motion of support for the Venezuelan government.
Yeah. I mean, the left will go down. The left have now their cars on the mast on Venezuela. They will stand by that until the bitter end, which happened like 5 years ago.
Yep.
But they're still standing by it. Anyway, so bad news for any of our listeners in New South Wales. You only have ownership over your property for 180 days out of the year. So New South Wales government, obviously Airbnb, pretty big thing at the moment. If you don't know what Airbnb is, it's basically you can... sort of let out your house as a sort of hotel arrangement. If you're not there, or maybe you've got a guest room, you can put your room up on the app and say, hey, you can stay here for this amount of money. Here's the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone's okay with that, they come in, they stay, et cetera, et cetera. And there's like a rating system, like this guy throws parties or anything. Anyway.
Like Uber for hotels.
Yeah,
but not really, because they're not hotels.
And you don't drive anywhere.
Imperfect analogy.
But you're trying, and that's what I really want. New South Wales government has shut it down. They say you can only let out your house for Airbnb for 180 days of the year, to which I would say, but it's their house.
What? How did this come about?
So, well, we don't know how it's come about. Like, we can always suspect that the hotel lobby has been tapping a few people on the shoulder.
Yeah, one of those.
So, what I did like was Planning Minister Anthony Roberts from New South Wales said that the Sydney cap of 180 days was designed to mitigate against potential unintended consequences on rental affordability. Which I like, it's just like, well, we don't know why this is bad, but it is.
How would that possibly be impacting the rental market?
Well, Pete, because people stay and then rents go down and, yeah, if you're not seeing it, Pete.
Can't even work it out.
Yeah, look, it's obviously, it's a pretty bad idea and it doesn't smell a lot for Liberty. What I want to know is how do they find out that you're not... Like, you're letting out your house for 180 days on Airbnb.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe through the app or something.
Probably, yeah, setting up all these burner accounts. I was thinking, like, just go through, like, that. Actually, that's probably how they're going to do it. So I've stumbled across my own answer there. All right, we'll move on to another one. So last few weeks we've been talking about how Kanye West was tweeting a lot about his support for Trump and a few other things. And there was a whole lot of people who were...
What's the name of that lady who's a big fan of? In the United States.
Oh, yeah. And he tweeted his support for Candace Owens.
Candace Owens.
Who is a conservative thinker.
We've sent her a request for an interview. Still waiting to hear back.
Okay. So Kanye supported Trump. And there was a lot of thinking of like, oh, what's Kanye done to his legacy? What's he done to his market affordability? Mm-hmm. Market, you know, how many albums is he going to sell now that he's a Trump supporter?
Yep.
Sounds like a lot. As of this morning, 7 of the top 21 most streamed tracks in the world on Spotify are from Kanye's new album, which is 7 songs long, so all of them are in the top 21, which I'd say is pretty good.
Wow, wait.
I'd say it's doing better than this podcast, which, marginally.
We don't want to set too high a bar for people out there, James. Aspiring artists. I've got a couple of questions about this.
Yeah.
Is why?
Well, I mean, Kanye's Kanye's still the biggest musician in the world. I didn't love the album. Nino, I don't know if you've heard it. You tend to...
Haven't.
Yeah. No?
Not really a fan of him, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not even College Dropout?
No.
Old Kanye. Old Kanye is good stuff.
I don't know.
Okay, well, I have read the album. Pete hasn't listened to anything past Oasis Breaking Up. But yeah, I didn't love the new album, so I don't think it's coming off its own merits or anything. There's some good tracks, but I think it's clearly star power. But it's kind of, to me, it's always interesting of just, there's all these people going, what's Kanye done to his legacy? And then bang, absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, it's obviously great publicity what he did. And there might be a few people sitting out there in the Rust Belt going, this Kanye is pretty good.
Yeah, I'm going to download. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's called I Like Being Bipolar. No, I Hate Being Bipolar. It's awesome, but it's also listed as Yee on Spotify. I don't quite know the marketing of it.
Anyway, it hasn't harmed his standing.
It has not harmed his dad. And yeah, my advice to any emerging musicians out there who kind of want to get ahead in the game is to come out as a Trump supporter. Apparently does pretty good things to how your chart success is going to go.
Well, who knew that rock stars saying controversial things went well with the punters?
Yeah, who knew it all? Okay, so that's it for main stories. We've got one more that's just come out this morning from us. So we've got a new report out, 5 Principles of Red Tape Reduction. So if you are interested in our red tape stuff here at the IPA, then you're going to want to read this. It's a new report from great friends of the podcast, Daniel Wild and Dr. Darcy Allen. So I'll just read here from it. So business investment as a percentage of GDP is lower today than during the economically hostile Whitlam years. It is near crisis level lows. The key reason for this is red tape and overregulation. We don't need more reviews. We need urgent action. A complete, radical and immediate overhaul of Australia's broken regulatory system is needed and will cut red tape and boost business investment. So if that sounds like the kind of report you want to read, available on our website. And we'll probably talk to Darcy and or Daniel soon in the show to talk about.
Fantastic.
Cool. So let's go to those interviews with Bella and Jonathan Blanks. But before we do this podcast, thank you so much for downloading. Thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about it. People that you think might like the podcast, help spread the word. We've had a lot of new listeners come in over the last few weeks, so let's keep that going. If you are listening on iTunes, be a friend, give us that 5-star review, maybe leave a comment for the show, maybe leave your own Q&A clap moment or just something. But yeah, that's going to really help us out with the rankings. Now, Nina, pressing the buttons for us as always, what can people do if they want to become a member of the IPA?
Just visit our website, theipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And started as low as $22, you'll become part of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia and also exclusive events.
Okay, if that's not sending you to the website, I don't know what will. Let's go to those interviews. Okay, we are now joined once again. It's been a long time between drinks. She's finally back. Dr. Bella DeBrera, Director of the Foundations of Western Civilization Program here at the IPA. Bella, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm still here. I'm still directing.
Good.
Just hard to get a hold of.
Yeah, very busy.
She's so famous.
Dang busy. The one-woman media influencer, I've called her before, and I'll stand by it.
If she was a lefty, she'd be called a thought leader.
Yes.
But what am I called now that I'm not a
director? Madam Director.
Director of the Foundations of Western Civ Program.
Oh, yes.
All right. Now, one of the... Bella, by the time this podcast is out, your article in The Spectator Australia will be out, and it's the headline, which I really like, At Uni with Mrs. Potato Head. Now, it's not the diary section, so that never actually happened, but Bella, do you want to talk about what this article's saying and what the sort of scandal that you've come across is?
Yes, this article is about a thing that came to light about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was a news item that came that the Herald Sun came up with, and everyone panicked. And it was basically two city councils in Victoria, Manningham and Melbourne City Council, were going to go through all the libraries, the kindergartens, and the schools, and take out any books that they thought enforced gender stereotypes. So Noddy, Winnie the Pooh, Thomas Tank Engine, Barbie. Were all going to be taken out of the libraries, out of the shelves, and then chucked in a rubbish bin because they were enforcing gender stereotypes for preschoolers.
This is unusual coming from Manningham. This sounds more like a Darabin type.
It sounds
scenario.
Like I'm sure Darabin would get in on the act if they'd known about it.
I thought you were going to say it's unusual for Manningham because the first three letters are man.
Oh,
so they're going to have to change that.
I think they've got bigger problems.
They're going to have to change it to Personingham.
That is sexist.
Yeah, well, Personingham, as it shall henceforth be known in this podcast. Yeah.
I've got another one, Bella. Just before we get right into this, can you tell us a little bit more about Winnie the Pooh and how he's received in different countries?
Yes, I can. He is received quite oddly in different countries. Mm-hmm. He received in Poland because he was giving off the wrong vibes as a hermaphrodite.
He was banned in Poland
because he doesn't wear any underpants and he doesn't have any genitalia, so therefore he is giving the wrong gender example
message
to the other school. So poor Winnie the Pooh is a victim. Yeah.
They're coming at it from a slightly different angle.
They are.
Yeah.
but it's true. His t-shirt is very short and he doesn't wear any trousers.
Look, he's just a free bear, right?
Yep.
He only wants honey.
So, anyway.
Your decrees of society mean nothing to this bear.
Yeah.
Cool. But let's seriously talk about this. So, there was a big scandal. Like, it went front page of the Herald Sun. Like, they're getting rid of these books. And then the next day, the councils hit the PR trail. They were like, no, that's not the case. We're not throwing out these books. Where a bunch of other stuff has happened, but that doesn't seem to be quite what's happening either.
Yes, so the city council issued a decree, not a decree.
It's coming. It's
sorry.
All books
shall be banned. Hear ye all.
Yeah. We all parted ways. Someone was put in the stocks for leaking that to the Herald Sun.
No, the SBS also made a statement on their website, which is interesting, which is basically, no, we're not throwing away any books. It's all, you know, it's all fake news. It's rubbish. But it actually wasn't. What happened is that some bureaucrats from Melbourne City Council went to ANU a couple of years ago and asked them to do a research project looking into all the literature that had been written about gender stereotypes and bias in children, in preschool children. And so they asked, so this is a council asking a university for this research. And the recommendations in the research were what the which is where this news came from, which was the idea of getting rid of these books and not letting your children play with these toys and banning the use of girl and boy and all this kind of stuff. So it wasn't nothing; it was actually genuine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of the thing where, because it got so much negative coverage, they sort of got together and were like, well, we weren't expecting the negative coverage, so let's just say we're not doing the bad thing.
Yeah, let's just say we're not doing it. But yeah, it was backtracking. Sorry. It was serious backtracking. But you know that this is this in a year's time or in 6 months' time, they'll sort of bring it out again. Maybe they won't make it so obvious. They'll do it a bit more subtly.
Mm. My theory about stuff like this is ordinary punters out there go, oh, how crazy is the council? Ha ha, isn't this funny? They don't realise the huge kind of cycle of taxpayer money that's going after this stuff. So bureaucrats from Melbourne City Council going to publicly funded academics at ANU, I think you said,
yeah,
and saying, we need this problem that doesn't exist. We need you to find a solution for it. Them coming back with research and then these crazy ideas coming through. These aren't just stupid ideas that someone's come up with in council, this stuff that's actually we've been charged for. And that's the part of it that kind of gets my goat. Because, like, I don't care. I mean, people can research what they want, but I don't feel like I should have to pay for it.
Well, it is. It's really the serious side of it is that it is social engineering, and it's social engineering at our expense, and we're paying for it. And we have no say. The councils just go off and do these things, and the universities are collaborate with them, and it's nothing more than pernicious social engineering at our expense.
At what point was Thomas the Tank... Oh, I suppose his name is Thomas, but like I never really felt that gender was one of the main things going on in Thomas the Tank Engine. That's just my
thought. No, but I think
I was a big fan of Thomas the Tank Engine.
The problem is they're associating a train with a male, with maleness.
Right. Yeah, but the Fat Controller, like, he's also a male. I don't think he's one of the heroes of the story.
Yes, so. But he's still probably got an engineering degree or something, so this is the problem.
Yeah.
If it was Thomasina and... does he have a controller? Does he have a controller, the fat guy? What's his name?
No, it's just the Fat Controller. All right, it's one of the more done by characters. Like, literally, the only way we know him is the Fat Controller. Like, the fat thing is the only...
And controlling.
Yeah.
It's not.
Although, in one of the Thomas the Tank Engine episodes, I remember an engine stopped working, so he had it bricked up. And, like, that was just the end of the episode.
Harsh.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm happy history is not remembered for the Fat Controller too well. Cool.
So, Bella, one other thing about this research, which we haven't quite got to yet, is that it says specifically young girls will have more, will think they can achieve a broader range of career goals if they play with a Mr. Potato Head, or Mrs. Potato Head, I assume, versus if they play with a Barbie.
Yeah, they gave...
Talk us through that.
This is one of the experiments, the so-called scientific experiments that they did with these under fives. So one group was given, first of all, a Barbie to play with, and then they were given a Mrs. Potato Head to play with. And then they asked them the same question at the end, which is... Well, I don't know what the question was.
Do you want to be a doctor?
Do you want to be... But the outcome was that the girls who played with Mrs. Potato Head thought that there were more career options open to them than the girls that played with Barbie. So they're trying to say that... the toys you play with will then will mean that you will be a success or you won't be a success in life. So for girls, you'll be a success if you become an engineer or a mathematician or a scientist, and you'll be a failure if you don't.
Go on.
Yeah, anyway, so it's just crazy.
Let's assume that they've controlled for all the other factors there that could contribute to the answer of those girls, right? Which they probably have. What does that mean, though? You can't play with a toy that's a woman. You should play with a toy that's a vegetable. How does that impact?
Yes, or Lego.
I need to read the report.
Yeah. No, well, I can sort of see it because there's one thing the potato heads teach you is that the complete possibilities that change provides, because you can put the mouth in the eye socket and the eye in the mouth socket.
You can be a Picasso-esque.
Yeah, like anything, anything is possible. Therefore, anything is possible for you. So get out there and play with this potato head. That's what I'm going
to
say.
James is on board.
Yeah, I'm on board. What's this guy's health? I'll call up the next report.
Yeah. There you go.
I think the point is they don't like the femininity of the womanness of Barbie. She's too much of a gender. She's definitely a female. Whereas Mrs. Potato Head, she's called Mrs., but, you know, she's just a potato. There's not...
No, she was one of the saving graces.
Oh, is right. She is just a potato when it's all said and done.
No, it's so much more than a potato. Like we said, Picasso painting in 5 seconds. A stand-up Mrs. Potato Head doll can become a Picasso painting.
She can become a Mr.
Seconds.
Potato Head in 2 seconds.
Exactly. The bit of ingenuity.
Yeah.
I want to do STEM.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this other story. I mean, if you want to read about that, sorry, the article is At Uni with Mrs. Potato Head. It's going to be on the Spectator Australia website. It's also going to be the hard copy of the Spectator Australia on Monday, I think it was, Bella.
Yep.
And it's also going to be available for you to read on our website. We'll talk about another story that's been all across the papers this week, and Pete and I have already discussed it in the show. So the Ramsey Foundation, they try to get a sort of course on Western civilization up at Australian National University, and the ANU said no. So, Bella, what happened to make them say no, and what does that sort of mean for the state of Western civilization in Australian universities?
What happened was that the students and then the academics got involved. So the unions basically got involved. And I noted that there were only 50 signatures on that petition, and that was collected in like 3 or 4 months. And
so what was the petition?
Just so in the case petition, how... sorry, the petition was we don't want this Western civilization course on our campus because it's racist and it promotes hate and bigot and all those kind of things. And there's 24,000, I think, odd students at ANU, and then you have 50 signatures on one small petition.
I mean, that works
so
for me.
Think it's not really out. It's not really revolutionary stuff, is it? It's not people. It's not students over being able to overthrow a.
It's not a majority.
It's not a majority by any stretch of the imagination. But as soon as the academics got involved, though, that's when the university started to cave, and that's when the vice chancellor came out and said, "We're not going to be entering into negotiations anymore with Ramsey, and thanks for your generous offer, but we're going to say no."
Right.
It's odd because universities, if universities love one thing, it's money. And for them to turn back so much cash on the back of 50 signatures is a sort of a special level of cowardice, really, when you think about it. And it's a bit like the Bjorn Lomborg thing where it was accepted and then after a bit of pressure from the staff, kind of they wobbled and went back on it, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's cowardice. It's cowardice on behalf of the administration, but it also shows just how attached to the ideology the academics are, that they will reject money and they will reject something that is essentially good and something that will be educating their students, just on the grounds of misplaced belief of what Western civilization is, and they've been peddling this propaganda for so long that they actually believe it. And they're actually terrified of the concept of someone coming along and talking about Western civilization in glowing rather than disparaging terms.
Do we have no professors who are like either not conservative or liberal or sort of classical liberal or even people from the other side who think, I don't agree with this, but what's wrong with it being taught? Are there no professors sort of standing up for academic freedom at ANU about this?
I think if they were, they would have said something by now.
Yeah.
You know, I was just watching something else about...
I think the James Cook saga has kept a lot of university professors storm about going against the official line.
It would take a lot of bravery to stand... You sort of lose your job. It's that kind of level of things now. And I think they have just been replaced over the years with... As soon as one position vanishes, then they replace someone with who's interested in gender studies or all these kind of... So it's just been a sort of gradual phasing out of any academics who might have wanted to teach Western Civ. And the other problem is... Where are you going to find people that can teach it now?
Well, do you know what I thought just occurred to me, Bella? You have written 5 books and you did a PhD at Cambridge University. Like, we are talking quality academic stock here. I think you would be... They would love you down there at
ANU.
Melbourne Uni or any you know...
No, they'd hate me. That's the point.
Really?
We want to hang on to Bella. She's really talented. She does a lot of very good work for the IPA.
Oh, right, you can split it. You can do both.
Bella's got tons
of
time.
I think I might have done myself out of a job with any university.
I saw you moulding young minds.
But you'll mould more young minds at the IPA than you will at university. I'll say that.
Oh, yes.
Cool. So if you guys want to learn more about the sort of the state of Western civilization and these sort of studies at the Australian campuses, I guess. Sorry, sort of lost track of them. Stop listening to myself mid-sentence, which is what I recommend most people do when I start talking, but it's not helpful for me. But anyway, Bella, you have a really cool report on identity politics at Australian universities. That's still on our website as well. Really great reading if you do want to learn more about this very important issue. So we're all a bit sad right now thinking about the state of Western Civ on campus, so let's lighten things up a bit. Bella, pitch Cobra Kai to us.
Yeah.
Because I haven't watched it and I'm still on the fence about it.
Okay, Cobra Kai is the best thing I've seen all year. It's YouTube Red, which I hadn't heard for. You have to pay, but they suck you in after 2 episodes. So the first 2 episodes are free, and then you have to pay, but I willingly handed over my card details because I wanted to know what was going to happen. Like $11 or something.
What were your details?
And then you cancel after a month. Sorry. I don't know how to find them out again because I was going to pass them on to my neighbour.
Nearly got that.
The premise is it's 30 years after Karate Kid.
Right.
Everyone's grown up. We have the main characters. I don't want to give too much away,
What's the twist at the end of the season?
It's so brilliant because it's actually they've done, and I figured this out. They've tapped into the people who watch Jordan Peterson stuff. They've tapped into this sort of the conservatives who watch stuff on YouTube, and they've made this series for them because it's really subversive.
Right.
So the main character, I don't know if you remember the blonde guy that Karate Kid. wins over in Karate Kid.
James, no,
I have not seen the Karate Kid.
Oh, well, it's, anyway, so no one's going to know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so the blonde, so the blonde guy that's grown up is stuck in the 80s, so he doesn't know anything about what's going on. He doesn't know Facebook. He calls iComputers. Mm. He hates the whole idea of political correctness.
So
it's Morgan Beg. Beg, who knows karate, yeah, and has a drinking problem.
Well, so it's Morgan Beg.
But there's some really great scenes that really made me laugh, and it really is subversive. It's the best thing that's on at the moment because it really takes the mickey out of all the lefty craziness.
So if you're a fan of Karate Kid,
yep,
fan of Jordan Peterson,
yep,
fan of Kung Fu, karate.
The karate.
Taekwondo.
Karate kicked. They called him the Karate Kid because he didn't do kung fu. He did karate. It's not like the Karate Kid did jujitsu.
I'm just mate. No, the Kung Fu Kid doesn't sell movies to me. All right.
If you're a fan,
that is really tickled Bella.
Jujitsu Kid.
Yeah. Bella's lost it.
Bella's
sorry.
We're all a bit loopy here. It's been a long day.
If you're a fan of classical liberalism, James.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Watch Cobra Kai. I really, you know, I was a bit dubious at the start, and the first episode was okay, but it's really good.
This is
it's
like really Kanye West conservative pop culture.
Yes, it's conservative pop culture.
Any TV shows for you, Pete?
That I watch?
Yeah. I'm just having TV club at the end here.
No, I don't. No.
Because my theory is Pete's seen like four movies.
Pete's seen four.
When you said Karate Kid to Pete, he just gave you the blankest of blank
stares. Surely you've seen
Karate Kid. I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it.
Nina's seen Karate Kid.
All right. Cool. Dr. Bella DeBrera, as always, absolute pleasure. Welcome back on at any point that you want.
Thank you.
My name's Chris Berg, and I'm here with Jonathan Blanks. He's a research associate in the Cato Institute's Project on Criminal Justice. We're at the Friedman 18 conference, and you've come in to talk to them about your work in criminal justice work. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So can you tell me a little bit about what Cato is doing in the criminal justice space and in your area particularly?
Yeah, so we have developed a strategic blueprint, and so we're tackling four main issues. The first is what we call unconstitutional overcriminalization. That is basically that the government has decided that whatever it wants to diminish or to discourage, it decides to use a criminal law to do it. And so you get this point where people are digging in their backyards against, you know, some federal regulation, and they're facing jail time for it. And we also apply that further to, say, the drug war, where it's like we don't want people necessarily to go out and get high or anything like that. But
only if they want to.
If they want to and they're adults and they're not going to harm anyone else, obviously we don't have a problem with it. But that we shouldn't be using cages and cops and guns to discourage that. The second is my area, which is self-defeating policing. Basically, what this means is that we've instituted policies and practices in the enforcement of our criminal law that actually creates a much larger gap between the police and the public that they serve. If they're alienating people trying to enforce usually drug laws, sometimes gun laws, by stopping them for no reason, searching them, sometimes unconstitutionally. They're trying to coerce them to give up their rights to not be searched by police officers. And it makes policing harder because when they come around to solve real crimes, real much harder crimes, murder, robbery, that sort of thing, they don't get public cooperation, and then you can't solve any crimes. The third is we talk about the coercive nature of plea bargaining. Basically, our system is so bad that 95% of all of our guilty pleas come by way of plea bargain. For those who don't know what that is, instead of going into a courtroom and you have we have a confrontational system where you have a prosecutor and defense counsel, and they present the case to a jury, and there's a judge sitting there to make sure everyone plays by the rules, and the government's job is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed a crime, and it is worthy of public sanction to the point of the criminal law, and 12 jurors have to be unanimous to agree with the government for that to happen. That never happens in the United States system effectively. You see like high profile cases of celebrities that can afford the $1 million lawyers to go in and hash it out and try and get off. But unfortunately, our system has so many laws in it. The unconstitutional overcriminalization that I talked about allows prosecutors to stack up laws and get and basically convince, sometimes presumptively, I mean, to present literally innocent people to plead guilty because the idea that they would face this much larger penalty if they decided to exercise their constitutional right to a trial, that it is, becomes a rational decision to plead guilty.
Is that a realistic threat that they, are they, from their perspective, are they making the right decision? I mean, are they making the right risk?
I mean, it depends.
Or
are they
coerced into it?
It's coercive inherently, whether or not. You don't need to have a police officer that's intentionally framing someone for something, that they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, someone got the wrong eyewitness account, whatever. But if the case is much worse, that it's going to be very difficult. Like if it's your word against a police officer's, juries are going to believe the police officer more time than not. And again, the way we enforce our laws is usually racially segregated. And so it's going to be... It's a poor black man's word against, you know, a police officer. Police officer is going to win in court most of the time. Not that we actually know this going to happen too much, because again, 95% of all of guilty pleas, I mean, guilty charges come through plea bargains. So they never see the inside of a courtroom other than to just say, yeah, you're guilty, and that's the extent of it.
And I presume this feeds into just a massive over-incarceration crisis that the U.S. has.
Oh, absolutely. What we've done is we've accelerated the way we've locked people up by just jacking up the sentences. The legislature basically decides it wants to criminalize anything that it wants to discourage, and then when people continue to do it, their answer is to just keep cranking up the sentence, even though all social science says what actually discourages people from committing crimes is legitimacy of the government, which they're undermining through their bad policing, and the certainty of being caught, which, again, when they're very good at catching low-level crimes for, like, drug use. Number one reason to be arrested in the United States is marijuana possession. But they're for robbery, rape, murder, are actually all eclipsed by marijuana arrests because that's where the police are focusing their resources, and so that's who's getting thrown in jail.
Yeah, my colleague at the IPA, Andrew Bushnell, is running a criminal justice project at the moment, and one of his arguments that I quite like, and I think this is also Cato's position, is that, you know, you want swift, certain, and expected punishment for various things, whether that's if you're on probation or whether you're on parole or certainly in your first offense. You got to know that that's going to occur.
Right, and again, you want it to be not only swift, certain, you also want it to be fair. You know, the idea that if you're a drug offender, say, for example, if you let's say you're in college and you get caught, you get pulled over and the cop smells weed and he arrests you. In certain states, and it's your first offense, you're automatically going to rehab. That's not necessarily what you need. Actually, the medical science says that about 10% of all drug users, whether it's alcohol, you know, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, doesn't matter. Only 10% of the users become problem users, which means 90% of people don't get addicted. They don't, you know, they can use it casually and go on about their lives. But if you have an automatic, you know, rehab regime, what you're doing is propping up the rehab system with a bunch of federal government money. And on top of it, you're giving it to people who don't necessarily need it. And yet the incentives so often are set up that repeat offenders and people who have addiction problems are the people who need that rehab the most. But because they're repeat offenders, they're not necessarily eligible for it. And so we have this really perverse incentive structure where the people who need the rehab the most are ineligible for it, and the people who don't need it at all are put in there as opposed to going to jail, which doesn't make any sense.
I'd like to return to the first plank in the Cato criminal justice project, which was the over-criminalization point. Because mm-hmm. I think that I've seen, and I'm not sure how apocryphal this is, that the average American commits 5 felonies a day or something. And I'm sure that's that has some detailed problems. But I'm interested to see what your view and what Cato's view is about how this over-criminalization just reflects the growth of regulation, the growth of red tape, the growth of government's involvement in the economy in general.
I think the statistic you're looking at, an adjunct of Cato named Harvey Silverglate wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day.
Oh.
So it's like, well, it's close. It's like,
we're inflating it every couple of years.
Well, the issue is, and no one really knows, but the particularly in the federal system, the laws have grown so exponentially that we actually don't know how many laws there are. We just don't. In one of the criminal justice reform bills that has been batted around in the past few years on the federal level actually requires the federal government to count the crimes that they consider federal offenses.
Oh, that would be much too hard work for
them. No, right? But that's the thing. It's like, here you have, you know, the old adage, it's like, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Well, actually, it should be. If you don't know that you're committing a crime, the idea that the government's going to throw you in a cage for violating it is absolutely insane. And what when you hear all these horror stories about people who are, you know, they're digging near a wetland or doing something that they understand may be running afoul of something, they call the government. One government agency gives them an answer, and they follow that to the letter. Then another agency comes in and serves them with a warrant. Serves them with, a regulation violation saying, oh, no, you did this. He's like, well, we tried to do it right. And they're like, oh, they gave you the wrong information and it's a strict liability offense, so you're still on the hook for it. And that's just absurd. The purpose of the criminal law is to carry social sanction of the society, saying, we have found this so against what it is to be in civil society. You violated someone's rights, therefore you must be punished, or you must give them redress in some sort of way. And our regulatory state has become just this unbelievable maze of regulations that may or may not carry criminal penalties. It all depends on how any administration, any part of the government wants to interpret that, and maybe apply some weird, apply some criminal law to it. We had this one case that went up to the Supreme Court twice, and this woman who found out that her best friend got pregnant. Unfortunately, it was by the woman's husband, not the best friend's husband, that her best friend was impregnated by her own husband. And she happened to be a chemist. And so to get revenge against the best friend who cheated with her husband, that she put a corrosive chemical on the handle of the woman's car, the best friend's car, and on the mailbox. Now, you would think that would be like mail tampering or something like that, which is a federal offense and carries penalties. But no. Some federal prosecutor decided to prosecute this woman under a violation of the Chemical Weapons Treaty. And it went to the Supreme Court twice. First, the government said that she couldn't challenge it because it was a decision by the government, and they can't even challenge it. She can either plead guilty or not guilty. And she succeeded on that 9-0, got all Supreme Court justice's degree on that. And then she went up the second time to like judge it on the merits. And sure enough, the Supreme Court said 9-0. There is no way that this woman is guilty of violating an accord between two countries. So that's just how absurd our system has been and has gotten. And it's really high time that we start rolling these back. But the bare minimum that we can do is at least have the government come forward and say, these are the laws, these are the rules that we say you violate, and we can throw you in prison.
And isn't that the problem? I mean, the stories that you're telling, they're stories of just massive discretion. So it's prosecutors that not only the prosecutors aren't following a set of rules; they're making discretionary choices about which crimes to charge, under which the Chemical Weapons Treaty, and so forth. How do we start reining? How can we pull them back to a sort of rules based order again?
There are a few different issues going on. First of all, DOJ policy, it was reinstituted by current Attorney General Jeff Sessions, that you have to charge as much as you can on anything that you can prove in court, you should throw at the defendant, and then from the, and then you can work the plea bargain from there. That's not justice. That's just a conviction machine. And if you're going to call yourself the Justice Department, then justice should actually be part of what you're trying to do. But unfortunately, whereas your local prosecutor, you know, in your county is elected more often than not, DOJ appointments, federal lawyers are appointed, and they serve at the will of the whim of the president, and therefore they are very hard to remove individually because they don't have any political there's no democratic process to get them out. The only thing you can do is put pressure on the president to change. And it depends on the president whether or not they want to do that. So long as DOJ policy is what it is, which is to charge as much as you can, you have to start repealing the laws that give these people so much power.
There's been, to bring it to that national level as well, there's been a decade or so of conservative criminal justice reform. So conservatives are interested in the over-incarceration problem. And I know that the Trump administration has been a challenge to that in some ways, but also is they've been making words about, or they've been talking in recent days, in fact, about criminal justice. Can you give us an assessment of where conservative criminal justice reform is under the Trump administration now?
It's not good. The recent White House summit on prisons is a good step. Basically, they have decided that instead of working on sentencing reform and, you know, criminal law reform generally, they're going to focus strictly on prison reform, which is basically reentry issues, getting improving good time benefits. Basically, if you're in prison and you're sentenced to, say, 7 years, and you serve your time admirably, you don't have any demerits for, you know, misbehavior, you can enroll in certain programs like job training and that sort of thing. And if you do that, you can get more time off. And so there's a bill that the White House has put their force behind that primarily through the work of Jared Kushner that will increase the amount of good time that inmates can use to get home. It also increases access to halfway houses, which is a really kind of convoluted system that isn't working as well as it should. But it really is a step down from what had been going on in the years previous. At the state level, states like completely red states, conservative states like Texas and Georgia have been leading the way all across the country among all states to de-incarcerate, to find alternatives to incarceration, to find rehab for people who need it rather than people who just violate a criminal law, and trying to understand that because it's really expensive and it's not in the public interest to lock people up for a very long time, because if you're trying to make them better so they don't reoffend, you know, just throwing them in a cage and forgetting about them for 7 years isn't yep. going to do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. Welcome to Australia, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your trip.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you too, Dr. Bella DeBurra and Jonathan Blanks, for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. Mm. So let us go through some stories that made us laugh this week. If I might start off, Pete.
Yes.
So this story got a fair bit of play in Australia. So the NBN, obviously one of the scourges of anyone who cares about low government costs and probably good policy, I guess.
It's almost out. It's almost rolled out.
It's almost rolled out. Huge.
Mm. Oh, I don't know if that's true.
They've certainly been saying it for a few years. So anyway, the NBN co-chief executive Bill Morrow was at a parliamentary hearing this week, and he said that the NBN is evaluating slowing down downloads for users in peak times. Mm-hmm. And the reason was heavy users of likely targeted fair use policy were going to be gamers. So he's basically saying NBN, it's the rollout is being slowed down because people are using the internet for gaming.
What's his name?
Bill Morrow.
Bill, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't know how you could have predicted that the internet would be used by gamers for gaming. No one saw that coming.
Yeah, exactly.
That hasn't been a thing happening for 10 years.
So what's he saying? That because these guys are jumping on during peak times,
yeah,
playing games.
It's just harder for the NBN overall to go out.
Isn't it the purpose of an NBN?
Yeah, I would have thought people using the NBN was the purpose of the NBN, but apparently you have to be using it in more productive ways, I guess.
Internet use is too much.
Yes, and you need to cut that. Stop using the internet.
Well, you know, it might be good to get a bit of sun, a bit of time out away from the screen.
Yep.
I don't know.
I think it's more up to people.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've said it before, I'll say it again. The press conference to say that the full rollout of the NBN has been completed will take place 45 minutes before its Silicon Valley technology that renders broadband obsolete gets published.
Or many years after that happens.
Yeah, we had that whole rant about how like future generations would finally like go, plug it in, and then we finally have NBN after our civilization has collapsed.
Bring back the modems with the...
The dial-up?
Yeah, the noise.
Yeah.
Do the noise. Can you do the noise, Nana? Yeah,
that's a one.
I miss that. That reminds me of my youth.
I know.
Pete grew up in 1974. So, Pete... sorry.
I dropped my pen.
I didn't see you running away from the microphone. Cool. Do you want to talk about one of your ones?
I do.
I forgot which one you wanted.
I want to talk about incel first.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
Incel always makes me laugh.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Pete's target demographic. They're the incel world.
My people. No, kidding, obviously. Incel makes me laugh because... what adult human being hasn't been involuntarily celibate at some point in their time?
I also want to go, like, in a day of age where everything you put on the internet is, like, recorded and then one day used to fire you, why are so many people volunteering themselves as incels? Like, do you really want the rest of your life people can just go, that was a really lovely date with that guy, let's just Google him, and that's something.
You're going to stay involuntarily celibate for a bit longer. And also, I mean, at least, you know, I mean... No, I won't go there. Anyway, the point that we're talking about incel is because... They're funny, and because a really humorous piece appeared in The Guardian during the week, and I'm trying to think of a name for a segment for this kind of stuff. I will at some point do my job and come up with that. But anyway, let's just take it for what it is at the moment. Aaron Spampinato, and I apologise if I mispronounce your name.
Spampinato, I thought.
Okay, my apologies for that. Aaron, I should get people's names right, especially when I'm about to bag them, but... has written a piece in The Guardian during the week, how does the literary canon reinforce the logic of incel? And then the byline, incels aren't monsters of cruel internet culture. You could have fooled me. They are the product of the American literary canon that has long glorified male sexual frustration. Aaron, you've got us. In old books, there's heaps of horny boys. You're 100% correct. So, I'll read you a really good quote. Think of the literature you read in high school. One source of Hamlet's...
Becky McGee.
Yeah, exactly. One source of Hamlet's insanity, those around him find... Oh, sorry, let me read this properly. One source of Hamlet's insanity, those around him find it natural to assume, is his sexual frustration with Ophelia. Multiple characters in the play scheme to bring the two together, hoping that if she puts out, he'll calm the F down and not kill everyone.
Now, also saw that quote. My point is, that is not the reason for Hamlet's insanity. Like, the reason for his insanity is the ghost of his dead father told him to kill a new king. That's why he's insane.
Maybe he was horny too. Like,
yeah, well, who knows? But also, like, Hamlet then tries to fool everyone into thinking it's Ophelia so he can get away with all this, like, other scheming that he's doing. But it's like, if you first cab off... Because it's the first part of the, like, the literary canon that she uses to say that,
Hamlet.
You know, incels go back before internet culture.
Yep.
If the first one of your examples is wrong... Yeah. Maybe need to rethink your thesis. That is my thinking there.
Yeah, it's in what I want to call like the longbow lefty type thing.
Absolutely. Like, this so is the longest
easy,
of bows.
It's so easy to be a lefty columnist. You just go thing, oppression, column.
Yeah, here's something that everyone else is mad at, and here's something I'm mad at, and this is why they're linked.
Just, yeah, anyway, maybe I should...
You should be a lefty, Pete.
Change
you
careers.
Would be so,
it's so
good
much.
At it.
It's so much easier.
Yeah. Speaking of how easy it is to be a lefty, so obviously Google has been in the play for a long time about intellectual diversity. So you guys remember the James D'Amore thing, talking about how, you know, men are getting discriminated against at Google was sort of his theory. And Google finally started to wake up and realize they do need to be more diverse. And here's one they've done recently. So this tweet came from Jennifer, who's sort of spokesperson for Google. Big talk about inclusion and diversity at Google. So if you need any evidence, Google is making this priority. May I direct you to the salad emoji? We've removed the egg in Android P Beta 2, making this a more vegan, inclusive vegan salad. So they've removed the egg. It's now just like lettuce and tomatoes. Google's diverse now.
So this is, I've seen an image, right? So this is for emojis.
Yep.
So if you want to send a salad to someone, but not write the word salad, you want to send an emoji.
Yeah.
They used to have
an egg. Thousands of times that comes up.
Yeah. it used to have an egg in it, but now it doesn't.
Mm.
So there's a few things to unpack here.
Yep.
This could almost be a speaking truth to power.
Yep.
Because
does it come back? This is huge.
This is classic speaking truth to power, because she could go to the pub tonight and say, you know, I stood up for people today.
Yeah.
And she may well do that. So obviously there's that. But also there's something deeper here, James, because removing the egg is actually making the salad less diverse.
Speak your reasons.
Because there's just less stuff in it.
Like, oh,
there's just
right.
Less, it's just less. Do you know what I mean? And diversity as a thing is often frequently less diverse.
Yes, that's something.
That's so deep.
Well done, Pete.
Well done.
Thank you.
I was just going to say, yeah. So once I saw the eggless salad of the new Beta 2, I was inspired to finally treat vegans as human beings. It was just something about that salad that really spoke to me, and now I feel that they're people.
Now I get it.
But actually, like, how insecure do you have to be about your veganism that you've once sent a salad? Because obviously this wasn't something that they cooked up in a boardroom. I think like people were complaining.
Nah,
you've sent a salad emoji to someone and then you felt the need to write, by the way, of course I wouldn't have an egg in my salad. And then you got so heated that you then sent off an angry tweet to Google saying, I shouldn't have had to have been put in that situation. You should have a salad emoji that tells everyone that I'm still vegan.
Do you think that's it? So you think people wrote in and complained?
I think people have complained about that.
I reckon it's the demographic of the people who design emojis are like, this is a good idea.
Or maybe they're the people that complained.
Well,
it's like, well, I'm in this situation and I can solve it.
It's like your theory about social media managers, apart from you.
Yes. Are terrible. I'm the only one, a good one.
Anyway, so that's true.
Cool. I got,
but if they added something like croutons, that would make it more diverse. I mean, there's more stuff in it.
Yeah, that's
or
good.
Or like bacon.
And croutons are always the best part of the salad. Yeah. Bacon, yeah. Bacon is the best part of the salad.
They kick off the egg. They won't put a bacon on it.
Yeah. If the egg's out, the bacon is not coming back in.
I understand that, Nina. Thank you for pointing that out.
You're welcome.
Hey, play nice. Play nice. Cool. I got two more here. So first off, I called it. I absolutely called it. Dennis Rodman is trying to get himself into the Kim Jong-un talks with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I said it with Mary Kissel a few months ago. We all laughed saying, oh, wouldn't that be funny? And it's like now he's going to be in Singapore and he's trying to get in. Rodman's agent, Chris Volo, has accompanied the basketball player on four of his five trips to North Korea. This guy goes to North Korea a lot. Said in a phone call with the Washington Post on Wednesday that Rodman would, quote, love to go, but we have a few logistical things, end quote, to deal with before the trip can be confirmed. He's a busy man, Rodman. He's a very busy man.
Mate,
I don't know
stories.
If he has time to put in the international diplomacy talks. No, but that's a classic case of playing hard to get. But if Dennis Rodman does turn up to these talks, we need a live feed. Trump, Kim Jong-un, Dennis Rodman. That's electric television.
Is he been invited?
He hasn't officially been invited. People are still in the dark as to what Dennis Rodman's plans are. And I think Dennis Rodman's still in the dark to what Dennis Rodman's plans are. I think he's going to be in Singapore.
Oh.
And he's just going to chill.
Happen to be in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Wait, you guys here at this hotel as well?
Yeah,
that's crazy. That's crazy. Can I come in? So he hasn't been invited to the talks, but he's going to be in the city at the time.
Now, you've got a prediction about Dennis Rodman.
Do I?
Yep.
That's huge. Can you predict what my prediction is?
Dennis Rodman is going to win a Nobel.
Oh, yeah. I've been saying, yeah. Well, Dennis Rodman's, that's confirmed. Dennis Rodman
that's
will
confirmed.
Win.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
He could.
Yeah, if Dennis Rodman gets Trump and Kim Jong-un to denuclearize or demilitarize that zone, then it's over.
Yeah.
You've got to give Dennis Rodman the Nobel Peace Prize.
They certainly wouldn't give it to... They might have to give it to the leaders.
Yeah, would they rather give it to Trump or Dennis Rodman?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you're the Nobel Peace Prize guy, you hate Trump so much that you're going to say, let's give it to Rodman.
Yeah.
That speech would be electric.
Oh, well, you know, maybe he deserves it if he gets it done. Do you know,
he would pass out halfway through the speech. Anyway.
Do you know who's inexplicably really close with Dennis Rodman?
Who?
Luke Longley. Australian basketball legend Luke Longley.
They said they were in the same team.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's inexplicable. They won three rings together.
Nah, but like some, where's he from? Like Bendigo or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you
know. I'm sorry, that's very explicable to me. If you win three championships with a bloke, you're going to remember.
Why do you fight me?
Because it's so easy to fight.
Nah, it's just, it's inexplicable. They're two very different characters.
They're very, okay.
Straight up and down Aussie bloke characters. And this off the charts fella from America.
Okay, this is pointless.
Well, like the whole podcast or existence or...
Yeah,
well,
yes.
This conversation.
This is slightly more pointless than the rest of the things we do around here.
Anyway, right, Google Luke Longley, Dennis Rodman.
Now, all right. So, well, pointless is a good segue into my last one here. So, meditation app Calm. So, there's a lot of meditation apps going around these days about how to, you know, clear your mind and clear all the junk. Meditation app Calm, this is a good one. If you're having trouble sleeping, they've added highlights from the GDPR legislation to its roster. So, like EU legislation, they will read it out to you as you try and fall asleep. And nothing would make me go to sleep quicker than EU regulations.
General data protection regulation.
That's it.
From the EU.
Yeah. So, this guy, this like old British guy, used to do like the shipping forecast, Peter Jefferson.
Which are famous in Britain.
Are they?
For being like hypnotic and mesmerizing. And,
oh. Yeah. Maybe I should listen to him.
It's a real thing.
I'm definitely going to listen to him now.
Yeah. No, it's a thing, this guy.
All right, well, he's now reading out data legislation.
Yep. Well, no, he's reading out the highlights.
Highlights of the data
legislation. Because if you read the whole thing, he said it would take over a day.
Oh, okay.
But just reads out a highlight.
He's a busy man. He's got some shippings to forecast.
I think, actually, you know what? I don't know if they might have done an edition where he's got the whole thing, but it is just highlights.
Well, I was going to hopefully do a test run to see if it actually works, so... I've got two very stressed... Like, Nina's stressed out. She's listening to us natter on about Dennis Rodman. Yep. Pete's stressed out, hosting the world's greatest podcast. You know, it's taking its toll.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read out some legislation here from Australia. And if you are listening at home and you're operating some heavy machinery, I'd probably put it aside for a second just to see, like, in case you do fall asleep. So let's just see if this does relax you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So this comes from Part 1, Subsection 2, then Paragraph 7.
Of what?
The Historic Shipwrecks Act. I just, like, I was looking, like, through different legislations we have. I saw the Historic Shipwrecks Act, and I've never clicked on a link faster in my life.
Important.
Where the Governor-General is satisfied that such arrangements are made, apart from this act, with respect to Dutch shipwrecks or Dutch relics, make it appropriate to do so, the Governor-General may, by proclamation, declare that this act shall, on a date specified in the proclamation, I'm certainly getting sleepy, cease to apply, and in all relation to Dutch shipwrecks and Dutch relics, or such Dutch shipwrecks and Dutch relics as are in or have been removed from a specified part of the waters adjacent to Western Australia. How are we feeling?
That doesn't help me. I've got a million questions.
It doesn't work with me.
Why Dutch?
I think just the tone is not right.
Oh, so you're saying it's my fault?
Yeah,
it could be. Yeah.
You meant to be like boring.
It's like you have to have a polite tone, and it's like dreary, and you know, you're already so excited about it. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna test it. Well, it's not gonna work.
Okay, maybe I should have something a little and less also, exciting with the Dutch shipwrecks.
I started thinking about the legislation. Like, why do the Dutch people? Is there a different? You know, there must be some international agreement. Why is the Governor General?
Yeah, what was in those Dutch shipwrecks that were like, the government's like, we need to get involved?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's another red tape thing we need to fill. Well, the Australian government's like, we need to get in this shipwreck game.
It's an emerging sector.
I don't think it's emerging quickly, though.
It's submerging.
Oh!
Yeah. Okay.
Right, let's end the podcast there. All right. Thank you to Dr. Bella DeBera and to Jonathan Blanks for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. This podcast is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. So there's a million ways you guys can listen to it, a million ways your friends can listen to it if you want to start spreading the podcast. But if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you leave that 5-star review. Really helps us out with the rankings. Nina, where can people go if they want to be members?
Just visit the website, ipadoc.au, and click on the join button. And starting at as low as $22, you'll become the part of the Lotus Voice of Freedom in Australia.
That sounds awesome. See you guys next week.
See you later.